Good afternoon. It's a pleasure to introduce John Duffy, the Samuel H. McCoy II Professor of Law. Let me say a brief word about the chair itself. Samuel McCoy was a 1950 graduate of the law school and the senior vice president and general counsel of USF&G in Baltimore prior to his death in 1988. Jeff O'Connell held the McCoy chair from 1990 to 2012, and upon his retirement, John Duffy became a worthy successor. John joined our faculty in 2011 from George Washington University Law School. He had previously been on the Cardozo and William & Mary faculties. He received an undergraduate degree in physics from Harvard and a JD from Chicago, and clerked for Judge Stephen Williams on the DC Circuit and for Justice Scalia. Before entering law teaching, he served in the Justice Department's Office of Legal Counsel and as a practitioner with Covington & Burling. John is best known as an expert in intellectual property. Indeed, he has been identified as one of the most influential intellectual property lawyers in the nation. But he came to IP by way of administrative law and economic regulation. And he looks at IP through the lens of economic regulation and its analysis. Indeed, one of John's early writings on IP, and one of my personal favorites, is called The Marginal Cost Controversy in Intellectual Property. In it, John took on the many lawyers and economists who argued that the optimal patent system would both compensate the inventor for the invention, presumably through a public subsidy, and simultaneously make the invention available to the public at marginal cost. The idea has considerable intuitive appeal. Many of us have heard the economics of the pharmaceutical industry, for example, explained in the following way. The first pill costs $1 billion to make, and every additional one costs 50 cents. If we could come up with a way to reimburse the inventor for the $1 billion that it takes to develop the drug while charging everyone 50 cents per pill, we would achieve economic nirvana. The problem, as John pointed out, is that this nirvana is utterly unrealistic and never exists in real-world markets, a point made forcefully by the late Ronald Coase. John argued that the cost of achieving the first best world of subsidies plus marginal cost pricing in a decidedly second best world of individuals trying to game the system for their own advantage would likely match or exceed the deadweight loss of above marginal cost pricing. This was a novel and badly needed way of looking at intellectual property. A more recent article entitled The Inducement Standard of Patentability, written with Michael Abramowitz, proposes a legal test for patentability based both on economic analysis and Supreme Court precedent. Duffy and Abramowitz argue, drawing on Ed Kitch's pioneering work and Duffy's own subsequent analysis, that the fundamental purpose of the patent system is to induce an inventor to make early public disclosure of the new product or process. Thus, the test for patentability should focus principally on whether the invention is of a type that would not have been disclosed absent the inducement provided by the award of a patent. By the standards of law professors, John is unusually immersed in what practitioners of patent law are thinking and saying. As such, he brings to bear a formidable combination of economic theory, institutional analysis, and practical understanding to his scholarship. His recent Stanford Law Review article on business method patents is an interesting example. While commentators have widely credited and criticized a single decision of the Federal Circuit for opening the door to the patenting of business methods, John provided a fascinating and methodical study of changes in business and financial practice and in the thinking of the Patent and Trademark Office itself that gave rise to business method patents before the Federal Circuit had ever weighed in. Today, John will take a step back and talk more broadly about the way in which law can encourage or impede innovation. The topic is custom-made for John's trademark combination of economic reasoning and institutional and legal analysis. Please join me in welcoming the Samuel H. McCoy II Professor of Law, John Duffy.
Thank you very much, Paul, for that. It wouldn't be a good talk if it didn't involve technological glitches. But thank you very much for that, and an appearance by my daughter, of course. Well, that is interesting. The technology people will come here and fix this, I assure you. I wanted to take a step back today and talk, as Paul said, about something more broadly. I started out in the legal academy as really a lawyer or an academic who was very interested in the processes of government. I had clerked for two judges who both were former teachers of administrative law on the practices of government. And here we are. So I think we can get back. And I went and had a slight sojourn into intellectual property, which is a fascinating area of regulation that tries to foster innovation. Innovation is highly prized in our society. We think of the greatest new devices. We all love our new smartphones. We want the latest smartphone. Once again, my daughter would tell you that she wants the Apple 5 or 6 or whatever it is, not the old smartphone, or certainly not something as primitive as a landline. This culture of innovation that we prize so much, however, does not seem to extend into the law too much. And I think that's changing, and I think that we need to change it. We need to think about innovation, not just in our technology, our wires and bits, but also innovation in our legal system, in our legal code. I think this is very important, and that's what I'm going to spend my few minutes here talking about. Certainly most people in this room have heard when they think about legal innovation, they think back instantly to a quote from Justice Brandeis, very famous quote in New State Ice versus Liebman, where he said that it is one of the happy incidents of federalism that a single state can basically serve as a laboratory and engage in experimentation without risk to the rest of the country. He made this argument in a dissenting opinion, trying to encourage the court to allow states to engage in this process of experimentation. And his recognition of the tie between federalism and experimentation has led to a large literature, especially in the corporate area, that has suggested that this is a very important insight and that, in fact, states are engaged in a sort of continual process of experimentation that slowly but surely produces better law. I wanted to figure out the extent to which we think about legal innovation. So I decided to look. This is one technique that I have done. I did it in my Stanford article, which the dean just mentioned. But look and see how often legal scholars who are publishing in top law reviews, so I just took the top 10 law reviews, said how often do they think about or talk about legal innovation? And the answer is not that much. This is a graph of all articles per year that mention legal innovation in any way whatsoever. And as you can see, it's rarely more than 5 or 6 per year. There is perhaps a slight trend line. If you were to ask Excel to put a trend line on it, you'd see that there's a little bit of a trend line associated with it, but it's very small, and some people who are mathematically sophisticated are thinking it may not be so statistically significant. Looking at the later articles, there do seem to be more extensive discussions of legal innovation, more substantive discussions. The earlier articles do seem, in a sort of way that's hard to capture empirically, to just be offhanded mentions of legal innovation. And I think that that's a good thing, and we need to encourage more substantive treatment of legal innovation, looking at innovation and change in a special way, in a way that thinks about changes in law not just as inevitable, but as products of human creativity. And I want to say the inevitability is I think a lot of the ways that lawyers think about legal change is they often think about it as a process in which law sort of naturally responds to changes in technology and social conditions. One example is Robert Bork. This is a very famous passage in one of Bork's opinions while he was on the D.C. Circuit, just before he was nominated for the Supreme Court. His view was that he was talking about constitutional law here, for sure, something that a judge is not authorized to just change. But nonetheless, he thought that the way judges change law is they update fundamental values that are themselves unchanging to new technologies. And in this view, the change, the sort of spur for change, is outside of law. It's not inside of law. It's the technology that changes outside of law. So the Fourth Amendment gets updated because we have new electronics. It's not that we actually change law. And I think one of the best quotes is from a professor of law at Yale in a Columbia Law Review article, where he said, look, law does evolve. This was the very opening paragraphs of his article. Law evolves. But it does so only by feeding on ideas from the outside, not by inventing new ones. That's a very concise statement that I think actually is consistent with the way a lot of people in law think about changes in law. Another famous example of this inevitability hypothesis is the so-called positive theory of law and economics, pioneered by William Landis and Judge Posner. And their view is that the areas of law are best explained if judges create the decisions operating as if they're trying to promote efficiency. And this idea is very controversial. It's very controversial because it suggests that law somehow naturally follows efficiency. I think the best rejoinder to this, which I just have to put up here because I think it's so interesting, is from Richard Epstein, who says, if it turns out that the positive theory of economics of law, the positive theory of economics of law, simply says you always get it right, judges, even though you haven't known economics beforehand, then the best thing we should do is ignore economics, and then we'll sort of naturally get it right. And I think that's a great rejoinder to the positive theory of law and economics, that there has to be something a little bit more sophisticated than just saying, oh, of course, we're eventually going to get our law into an efficient manner. And even if that were true, it would still be an interesting question as to how long it would take law to become efficient, something that I have written about before. The last example I'll give you of inevitability, a sort of inevitability thesis, goes back to Oliver Wendell Holmes, which is a good place to start. He's actually an interesting case because he recognized that law often owes its form to the gradual historical development. But even in this era, the era of the early progressive era, the sort of dawn of the progressive era, he hoped for a better answer, that society could do better than simply saying, we're doing something because our fathers did it. And that he aspired to get law based on science. That wasn't exactly, again, in this era, I think people were still looking outside of law. They were looking for something beyond law, some sort of scientific answers, and that was consistent with the notion of the time, especially the administrative law writers of the time who were looking for scientific answers, who wanted to take regulatory problems out of legal structures, existing legal structures, and create scientific experts who would handle the problems outside of law. I want to give an alternative view of the way legal process occurs, and that's through creativity. And I'm going to give just a few examples where I think it's fairly clear that law did not just progress through an incremental process, nor did it follow technological change, but that there are, in fact, identifiable acts of creativity by specific individuals that push the law forward. The first example I will give is the idea of spectrum auctions. Now, this is law today. The government, the U.S. federal government, does not try to allocate spectrum. It auctions it off to the highest bidder. But when it was first proposed, and most people who've looked at this issue agree, it was proposed by a student in a student note. It was immediately met with derision. It was dismissed by a former chief economist at the FCC who said, well, this is just something that should be relegated, left in the realm in which it is merely the fashion of economists to amuse themselves. Kind of an interesting response from somebody who actually is an economist to say that as the criticism. The idea was picked up, apparently independently arrived at, in 1959, 8 years later, and by Ronald Coase, one of my favorite authors in the law and economics. And once again, he was ridiculed. You might think that a tenured professor at the University of Chicago would demand some respect at the University of Virginia, actually, at this point, he was at the University of Virginia. That is correct. He was just about to leave the University of Virginia to go to Chicago, unfortunately. But at this time, he was at the University of Virginia, and give him very much respect. It was met with the commissioner of the FCC asking him, are you spoofing us? Is this all just some sort of big joke? But nonetheless, this idea ultimately, despite the initial derision, and after about a third of a century, eventually became the public policy of the United States. Another example, and I have written on this example quite a bit, is the patent system. And the interesting thing, I think, sometimes a big idea can be lost in the weeds that we write about the patent system, we write about various doctrines in the patent system, but there is a really interesting fact about the patent system that no one seems to deny, which is that the patent system was invented precisely once in the world's history. No one independently, so far as anyone can tell, ever came up with the idea independently, other than the Venetian Republic in the 15th century. I've always thought that's an extraordinary thing. Different cultures, different city-states, different nation-states did not independently arrive at it. And from that one nation-state, the idea spread. Even some of the early English patents, the first English patent, indeed, on something that could plausibly be called an invention, was issued to a Venetian, fairly clearly establishing the connection, the historical connection between the original innovation and its spread throughout the world. This, I think, is something that is very important in terms of thinking about how the law works and how the law develops property rights. And it perhaps gives a significant caveat on the work of Harold Demsetz, who believed that property rights would develop naturally as technological and market changes produced a need for property rights. He gave a fairly famous example where Native Americans developed property rights because, in his article, the value of having property rights increased because of the arrival of Europeans who were willing to engage in fur trade. But Demsetz left the process by which property rights develop as law to what he called a black box, something that we didn't look into. It gradually would evolve and rights would occur. It may be that that a lot of interesting things are happening inside that black box. It may even be that a culture like the Native Americans may have developed property rights, not because of the arrival of a fur trade, in other words, not because of a market condition, but because of the arrival of a proven legal technology. In other words, their exposure to a property rights system that gave them the idea, much like the English got the idea of an intellectual property rights system in patents from the Venetians. It may be that the emergence of a property rights system requires the legal innovation and knowledge of the legal innovation. The third example is the Uniform Commercial Code. I think that's a masterpiece of statutory drafting. If any of you have ever taken it, it's actually sometimes fun to find the flaws in the Uniform Commercial Code, the UCC. It's interesting and fun to do because it's hard to find the flaws. And they're relatively well known and fairly small in number. Compare that to a modern regulatory statute like Dodd-Frank, And you think that there's a significant difference in terms of the quality of creativity that goes into the work. I think this is an interesting example because it is also tells a counter story to the standard jurisdictional competition argument that atomistic states can arrive at efficient law or good law on their own. The creation of this code tells a counter story where there was centralization of effort with significant expertise, some of the best professors in the nation, along with the American Law Institute, again, a centralized entity. These are some of the doctrines. If you were to look through the existing literature, such as it is, you would see a number of different aspects, both doctrines and institutions that are identified as fostering innovation. Again, the literature in this area is in its infancy. But nonetheless, federalism obviously has been identified by Brandeis and by later writers, especially in corporate law. Centralization and expertise is also identified as a way to establish innovative processes. And that is consistent. Those two themes is consistent with the technological innovation. There's a great debate in technological innovation of whether small atomistic competition is best or whether centralized large research institutions like the ones run by IBM or Google or in a different era, AT&T, are better at producing innovation. I think the correct answer is that both have some strengths and both have certain weaknesses. Common law processes are often identified as producing a greater degree of innovation. And my own research on the emergence of one important doctrine in patent law, the patentability standard that is now in every single nation in the world, suggests that this doctrine was created largely through common law processes because it began in France, and it spread to the United States. The United States copied a French statute, but nothing really ever happened to the statute in France. Whereas in the United States, it developed into a much different doctrine, something quite different than what the original idea was in the French statute. And that doctrine developed through a decisional process, an incremental and creative decisional process. Other examples, other things that might provide foster innovation are private processes, including private rights of action, incentive systems. And you might think, well, incentive systems to improve the law are relatively few and far between. There's very little intellectual property that you can get for improving the law right now. But it is not a null set. And anyone who tries to use the word restatement associated with anything creative will find that the American Law Institute claims a trademark on that very word, which asserts its intellectual, and it will assert its intellectual property against you if you try to use that word to describe something that you are working on. So there are some incentive systems. Experimentation and administrative agencies are also something that I will talk about in just a minute, but those are other structures that we might want to consider in determining, in deciding ways to foster innovation. There's a dark side to innovation. Innovation is destabilizing. We all know this in the technological space. We think of, and many technologists talk about the process of creative destruction. Creative destruction sounds fine if you're talking about your old phone. You say, you know, I want something new, so let's creatively destroy that old phone. It's not so clear that sounds good when you're talking about your government. Somehow the creative part doesn't sound so promising, and the destructive part sounds a lot more ominous. This insight, I think, goes back to a quote from Aristotle that is actually fairly famous in the patent literature. This is one of the earliest considerations of whether it would be a good idea to give somebody an incentive to create new innovations, something advantageous to the city. And Aristotle was considering a proposal, not really something like the patent system that we have, not something like what was invented in Venice in the 15th century, but something that was much more like a prize system for innovations. And he said, this idea is dangerous. The idea of creating innovations is dangerous. And he gave two reasons. The first, you can understand, that it will involve harassments. Well, that's just litigation. And anybody who looks at our innovation system and the incentive system that's designed to foster innovation understands that there's a lot of costs associated with that and a lot of harassments. But the other part of the other, his other objection is that it could cause changes in regimes. For years, when I taught patent law, I did not understand this. I thought that our modern society has evolved out of that, that we can handle technological change, we can get new computers and new phones and new ways of travel without having destabilization of society. But when you begin to think about the process of innovation moving into the law, Aristotle's words come back as words of wisdom, that the idea of stability is important too. The value of stability is very important because while innovation is great, it's not great if it leads to anarchy and destabilization of government processes. We have a lot of doctrines to foster stability in the law. These cut against and this is just a smattering of them. Stare decisis obviously forces courts to not change the law every time that they think that they might have a better idea. Divided governmental powers and other checks and balances are also ways slow down government and keep it from being perhaps more innovative than it otherwise would be. And another statute that, of course, I teach, which is the Administrative Procedure Act, is purposely designed to slow down or to add procedural protections onto the process of legal change. Without the Administrative Procedure Act, we might see a lot more experimentation by administrative agencies, a lot more change, and rapid change, too. We value stability, and therefore we have a statute that tries to enforce some degree of stability. If there's a central idea, the central idea of my talk is that that our legal culture has to develop a new field that's quite a bit different from parallel fields associated with intellectual property. In other words, those fields that try to optimize technological and expressive creativity. We need a field that really focuses on legal innovation as a separate field. And that field has a number of challenges that are present. First is instituting some sort of improved incentive structure. Currently, if someone comes up with a great new regulatory idea or a great new legal structure, there's simply no good reward, or almost no good reward, for that development. You might get a little bit of fame, as perhaps the student who authored that famous note did, but beyond that, there's precious little in terms of an incentive structure. And even if we do not extend intellectual property to these areas, we might think of improved prize systems or other subsidy systems that, while they too have their problems, might be better than nothing in this area. Another thing that must be thought about is creating an experimental environment, an environment that involves opportunities for both testing, randomized study, and serious data collection on legal innovations. Without a serious experimental environment, just coming up with new ideas for improved legal structures won't do us any good, because as most people who study innovation understand, the normal result of innovation, the normal result of an experiment is failure and not something that we want to continue. So we need to have some degree of testing with significant data collection. Encouraging private entrepreneurial activity by lawyers and by their guilds, in other words, by associations like the American Law Institute and the ABA, is also another way that in the past legal innovations have been developed. And in the future, we might devote more energy towards expressly trying to develop some sort of significant legal innovations in the legal profession. And that includes entrepreneurial activity by lawyers themselves. Lawyers themselves can be entrepreneurs, and in some very significant cases have created interesting legal structures that have gone out and developed on their own. The patent claim is one example. It's something that is in every single patent issued in every single country in the world. Most scholars trace that back to a single patent that was issued in the United States, and some clever lawyer decided to try to articulate in a single sentence what the scope of intellectual property rights was. That was not done by governmental mandate. It was instead done by private entrepreneurial activity by a lawyer who was trying to establish some sort of creative property protection for his client. I've already mentioned the problem of failure. Failure is a big problem in innovation, and it's an even bigger problem if we're going to talk about legal innovation. Legal innovation is going to, just like all innovation, is going to generate lots of failure. And that is a significant problem, a significant social problem, if we're talking about law. Legal systems are not designed to fail, and in our culture, a politician who champions a legal innovation that then produces bad results is likely to suffer significant adverse effects. That is something that every scholar of innovation would tell you has to be changed if you're going to create a culture of innovation and improve your technology of law. The last point I will make is that all of these things, all of these rather minor or new things, are nothing in comparison to changing attitudes towards innovation. If you said, let's say, 20, or if you said today, if you went to a judge and said, you are a great judge, you're very creative, I'm not so sure that many judges would take that as a compliment. Both lawyers and judges and our legal culture in general has to understand and aspire to innovate in creating new legal structures and better legal structures. It has to be valued within our culture. And that is, I think, the overarching problem to be tackled in the next half century or so if we're going to create a legal system that gets better with time and that improves people's lives. Thank you.